Good evening. So good to be back with you again tonight. If you'll be opening your Bibles to Hebrews, the 12th chapter, Hebrews chapter 12. I want to begin reading in this text, Hebrews chapter 12, a really great passage that we've actually appealed to on a number of occasions already this week. And I want to come back to this to talk about this idea about things we need to hear about helping the weak. I particularly do sermons like this in a meeting on a Wednesday night for the very reason that people who are typically here on Wednesday nights are going to be the ones who need a sermon like this, who are the ones who are going to be the ones who are going to have to hold up the hands of those who are weak and those who are struggling. And there's some helpful things, I think, from texts like Hebrews 12 and some of the other texts we're going to look at tonight in terms of helping us understand the right way to do that and how to help people who are struggling in their faith. There are always people who are having difficulties. There are always people who are going through hard times in life. And in fact, some of us here this evening might be going through difficulty in our life. And a crowd of any kind of number at any one time, about 25% of the people in that number are suffering some kind of crisis in their life. That's just a very general statistic in terms of a mass group of people that is reality. It can be financial, it could be health, it could be emotional issues with family. And there are all kinds of difficulties that people have in life. And a high percentage of people at any one time in any crowd are going through some kind of problem. And that is true even among God's people. And we need to be aware of that. We need to be conscious of the reality that we are here to build each other up and to help each other. And with that in mind, I think we need to be asking ourselves, what am I doing to help build people up? How am I fulfilling this, something which is really part of my duty as a Christian, especially within a congregation of God's people who is here for that purpose? If I was to ask you, what is the purpose of assembly, what would you answer? And I'm not asking you to answer out loud right now, but just think in your mind, what would your answer be? What is the purpose of our weekly assemblies? I think that there would be a few answers, a few common answers. I think the most dominant answer that I would get in most places for that question would be to worship God. That we're here to honor God or to worship God. And that's a really good answer. However, I think it's worth pointing out that in the Scriptures in the New Testament, really what is most dominant in this area about assembly is building one another up. Certainly lying behind that all the time is the worship of God and honoring Him in the things that we do. However, the Apostle Paul spends a great amount of time in places like 1 Corinthians chapter 14 and other texts where he's talking about the assembly focused on the reality of that what we are doing here is building each other up. We are encouraging one another. And so you see this in his letters to the brethren in Corinth. He says it a number of times in his letters to the brethren in Thessalonica, that they're to encourage one another with these words, or build up one another with these words. Part of what they're doing in this time in which they're struggling to do what's right in their society is they're coming together in a common goal, with a common faith, and they're trying to build each other up. They're trying to tell each other, you can do it. You can make it through these difficulties and through these struggles. The Hebrew letter, and for a great part of it, is for that purpose. You read through the letter to the Hebrews, and a lot of what the Hebrew writer is doing here in a very masterful sort of way in his argumentation, and he is deliberately arguing these points throughout the entire letter, it is the purpose of building these people up, trying to encourage them. He is showing them that there is this better way, and they need to keep attaching themselves to this better way, and they need to be encouraging each other to do that. And here are all the reasons why. And so that's why you have these great one-liners all throughout the book of Hebrews, like, exhort one another daily, so that you're not hardened by the deceitfulness of sin. Or do not forsake the assembly of the saints, but you're to stir one another up to love and to good works. And so there are these ideas, the common ideas that we appeal to very often that come from the book of Hebrews, and the basis of those is the reality, as he says a number of times in the book of Hebrews, that you have need of endurance, and they need to be committed. They need to be becoming stronger in their faith to God, and they need each other to help with that. In Hebrews chapter 12, the text I want us to begin with reading tonight, he is made these kinds of arguments all the way up into this point in chapter 12. He is talking about some of the problems they're going through. The discipline that's talked about here in the initial part of this passage. It's talking about a father's discipline and God allowing them to be disciplined so that they can grow. It is not really about punishment. Sometimes we make this mistake in thinking that God is punishing them in some way. This is about training. Discipline is about training. And so the things that are happening in their lives, God is allowing those things to happen, some of the persecution and some of the problems they're facing. And this is training them. It is building them up. It is strengthening them. And the context of this passage really bears that out. We don't have time to go into that tonight. But I want to begin in verse 12. In verse 12 of chapter 12, he has just completed that section about the Father and his discipline and him allowing us to grow and to be trained. And then he says this in conclusion of this: therefore, lift your drooping hands and strengthen your weak knees and make straight paths for your feet, so that what is lame may not be put out of joint, but rather be healed. Striving for peace with everyone, and for the holiness without which no one will see the Lord. See to it that no one fails to obtain the grace of God, that no root of bitterness springs up and causes trouble, and by it many become defiled. That no one is sexually immoral or unholy like Esau, who sold his birthright for a single meal. For you know that afterward, when he desired to inherit the blessing, he was rejected, for he found no chance to repent, though he sought it with tears. It is interesting to me in this text, as the writer is making this point, he ends with the story of Jacob and Esau. Two brothers who you would assume would love each other and care about each other. And Jacob finds Esau in this moment of vulnerability. He has been out, he's been hunting, he comes back, he is hungry, and Jacob has been there cooking and he has some food ready. And in a moment where he should have been helping his brother in his moment of weakness, when he should have been straightening his brother out and saying, I'll take care of you, you are not thinking straight, being willing to give up something so important for something so invaluable, just a bowl of soup. I am here for you, I'm going to lift you up. That's the idea of the passage here, really, in its context and the concept that the writer is giving. That's why he gives that example, in fact. He's showing these two brothers in what should be the natural reality of this situation, where Jacob should have been helping Esau, but in fact he does the very opposite. And the consequences of that were very dire. The result of Esau's life is in fact that he does not please his parents. He has not received the things he should have received. And some of this is by providence and the working of God that Jacob was going to receive the blessing. But God would have found a way to do this that would have worked according to his plan without Jacob acting in ways that were deceitful and wrong. And all of this, because of this behavior, caused problems in their family. All because Jacob took advantage of Esau, really on more than one occasion. This is just one of these occasions, where he took advantage of Esau and took what was not rightfully his. And in this situation, in a time when he should have been helping Esau out as a loving brother, in fact, he took advantage of him and took something that was not really his. And what the Hebrew writer wants these people to understand is that is the opposite of what we should be doing. There are people who are in moments of weakness. And he understands this about these brethren that he's writing to. In fact, that's really what the letter's all about. There are people who are struggling. He says, you should be teachers by now, but I've got to teach you again the first principles. You are so lacking in your faith, I have to build you up again. At one point, you were willing to give up your possessions. You were willing to be shamed publicly and openly for the cause of Christ, but now you're shying away from that. And so you need confidence. You have need of endurance. The same sorts of things are true of people today. Really, the statistics bear this out. And some studies about commitment within the Christian faith. Here are some ideas that are presented about this. That really, a majority of people who claim to be Christians claim they have a meaningful personal commitment to Jesus. Well, that's good. I'm glad that 81% of people who are Christians say they have a meaningful relationship with Jesus. That's the way it ought to be. It should be a very high percentage of people who claim that. Unfortunately, some of the other statistics show that things aren't quite as good as we would like them to be. Only 18% of them claim to make really any kind of true investment in their spiritual growth. So consider the discrepancy here between these two numbers. More than three-fourths say they have a very strong personal commitment, but only one-sixth actually invest in their growth spiritually. So the idea that they're really setting aside time for growth in various ways, whether it's prayer or whether they have some plan for this year, the ways in which they're going to grow, that they're really investing in themselves, in their spiritual life, in their commitment to Jesus. Only one-sixth of people who claim to be Christians say they do that. And just over half believe there is more to Christian life than they experience. That's fairly startling to me. I guess I'm not too surprised in some ways based on what I see in the world around me, but it is a little bit shocking that over half of the people who say they are Christians, many of whom say they have a personal commitment to Jesus, then say that there are things lacking in their Christian experience. There are just things missing in their spiritual life. I would suggest to you that one of the major problems along these lines is the way that people conceptualize God's people and the congregation of God's people, specifically in local areas. So, for instance, this group of people that meet here, and how we see that and how we perceive of this idea of what we call church, I think more accurately stated as a congregation, or an assembly of God's people that meet in this specific location. And I say that because of what these findings tell us about how people view this. Most self-identified Christians note that they feel comfortable and connected within their church. That's good. However, various measures show that there is not much vulnerability and accountability occurring within the context of those faith-based connections. Many self-identified Christians do not take their faith community seriously, whatever type it may be, as a place to which they should be open and held to biblical principles. Only one out of every five self-identified Christians believes that spiritual maturity requires a vital connection to a community of faith. Further, only one-third claims to have confessed their sins verbally to another believer at some point during the past quarter. Well, there are some significant problems with what is found with this idea here about the way people view church. And I would say one of those problems is that maybe we do in some ways recognize the point of being here, which is to honor and to glorify God. And we get that one area of what this is about. And I think in some regard, although I think it's done in very wrong ways in most places, unfortunately, that people at least have the idea that what they're doing when they come together is worshiping God. That's what they're trying to do, at least. But what this says is that what most people miss about what the congregation is all about is that it is a community of believers that is to be attached. They have fellowship in Christ. They have a common faith. They're to be building up and encouraging and comforting and strengthening each other. And a large percentage of these people don't even think it's very vital. I think, well, I could come if I want, but then I don't really have to come. I can have a meaningful relationship with Jesus without having to come to my congregation and worship. That's a big problem. Because the Bible is very clear about the reality that we need each other. And God is very clear all throughout the text of Scripture that part of His plan is that we are coming together as a congregation to build each other up, to be a part of each other's lives, To be a place where people can be open, where people can be held accountable to biblical principles, where in fact those things are commended within Scripture, and they are commanded in places like 1 Corinthians chapter 5, where someone isn't living right, and the congregation is told, you better take care of that. You need to hold this man up to biblical principles. And so we know there are some real problems if people just don't feel like that's important. Now, as is typically the case, these types of studies are very general. And so, again, I understand that. And I understand that there are some things about that that are going to be different in a group like this, or a group where I worship. But I would suggest to you that some of this is not too different in groups like these. For instance, think about this last statement. How often and how willing we are able to verbally speak to one another about our weaknesses, about the problems we have in our spiritual life. How often does that happen? Now, I don't know this group on a day-to-day basis. Obviously, I have just come here for 1 week, and I do know some of you from other things in life. But I am not around you all the time. And so it could be very different here than the way it is at home. I love the people where we are, and we are very close in some ways, but I will say this, and it's been true pretty much everywhere I have attended in my life, and that is that people are not open about their problems and about their weaknesses. They're not willing, most of the time at least, to share struggles that they are having, when in fact, that is one of the very reasons why we are to come together, is to confess to each other. Now, I'm not asking you to come together and have everybody file down to the front and stand up and to confess all their problems in front of the congregation. That is not the point of this sermon, or that's not the idea I'm promoting. But what I am saying is what the Hebrew writer is saying, which is we need to be coming together on a regular basis. We need to be confessing to one another, as James says. We need to have relationships with each other, and that requires being here. It requires being attached to people who are here. It requires putting an investment in this group, in this congregation, and showing that we are committed to what's happening here. And if we aren't doing that, we're not going to fulfill God's purpose for us. We're going to have a really hard time being strengthened and built up if we just kind of play church how we want to play it and do things the way that we want to do it. That is not a recipe for success. And in many ways, it seems sort of what like these Christians are doing here in the book of Hebrews, what they're being chided for in some situations, and they're being encouraged to no longer do in other places. That the congregation is vital. It is important. And you can go all the way back to the book of Acts and read through that book, and you can see it in the reality that almost every letter of the New Testament, especially those written by Paul, is written to congregations. Do we realize that? Do we think about that? So often we're focusing on the individual. We're focusing on what I need to do and what you need to do. That so often we miss the reality that Paul is writing to congregations, telling them things they need to do as a group. The group is important. And in fact, one of the things about Western society and American society that is so different than ancient society is that we are so individualistic and so focused on people and individuals rather than groups. That's just not the way they thought. They thought very differently than we do on those sorts of things. We are the most individualistic group in the history of the world in our country. And I'm not saying that that is in and of itself a negative thing. I'm just saying that's how we are, that we think about individuals. Where they thought in family structures, they thought in associations, in groups. That's how their lives were lived out in this urban environment, in these city-states they lived in back in Greek and Roman society. You did something wrong, it affected your whole family by necessity because you all lived together. And it spoke to your family. You didn't go move somewhere else very often and have your own life somewhere else where only it matters for you and for your immediate family. That's not how things were. If you acted in a bad way in your city, it spoke ill of your entire city. And in fact, the emperor could come and bring problems on your city because something of one person. It affects everyone in that whole area. And so almost by necessity, they thought at the group level, and that certainly would have been the case, even with these New Testament documents that we read, and so often think of in very individualistic terms. Yes, they do apply to us individually. But there's a reason why these are written to congregations. It's because there's a certain way that these groups are to function. And the reality is there would be people within those groups who were weak, who needed help. And I want us to understand the background of Hebrews chapter 12. So if you will, go back to Isaiah 35. Isaiah chapter 35, the Hebrew writer is actually borrowing this concept and quoting, in fact, from this and from the book of Proverbs, but the main concept is coming from Isaiah 35. This is a time in which the judgment has been pronounced upon Israel and Judah. Isaiah has revealed that the wrath of God, this divine warrior, he is going to come with vengeance upon Judah and upon Israel and upon all kinds of other nations. But there is this moment of comfort in Isaiah 35 that he's explaining to them. He's trying to build them up, those who truly are faithful, but are struggling to understand all the things that are taking place. He wants them to understand that God is going to come and redeem his people. And so he's described the destruction that's going to take place. But now there's the opposite of that. The wilderness and the dry land shall be glad. The desert shall rejoice and blossom like the crocus. It shall blossom abundantly and rejoice with joy and singing. The picture of destruction was that he was going to come wipe everything out. And there'd be no water in the land. But he said, there's a time coming when God is going to restore his people. So don't give up. That's the message. Strengthen, this is verse 3. Strengthen the weak hands. Make firm the feeble knees. Say to those who have an anxious heart, be strong, fear not. Behold, your God will come with vengeance, with the recompense of God. He will come and save you. Isaiah's prophecy and his picture of what was coming was very bleak. It was very gloomy. But he wanted those among the remnant to know that it was not time to give up. There was a time coming where God was going to come with vengeance. He was going to come and vindicate those who were truly his. And so what they needed to do was to strengthen the weak hands. And they needed to help those with feeble knees. They needed to save the anxious hearts. Fear not. Be strong. Don't give up. You keep working at it. Keep doing the will of God, because God is going to come and he's going to be your Savior. And so as he's using this in Hebrews chapter 12, he is promoting the same idea. He's telling them, don't give up. Be strong. Do not fear. You're going through all these difficulties. You're being persecuted. People are mocking you. They're slandering you. They're saying all kinds of evil things about you. Some of you are being thrown in prison. You haven't been persecuted to the point of bloodshed, he's going to say in just a minute. But you're going through lots of difficulties. But be strong. Fear not. God will deliver. You need to lift the drooping hands. You need to strengthen the weak knees. You need to look out and see those people who are struggling around you, and you need to help them. So let's talk about those who are weak. Because we know that they are among us. We know that there are weak people in our congregations. So how are we going to help them? Well, I think we need to try to understand them first. So then we can understand how we're going to help. First of all, some of this is just coming from talking to people who are weak in my life. And I think some of you will have experienced the same sorts of things. Those who are weak often know they are weak. They often can understand the reality they are weak in their faith. And so with that understanding, that should shape in some ways the way that we approach them and the way that we try to deal with the issues that they are having and the attitude that we take into this situation. If we come at them in a very self-righteous sort of way, there's going to be pushback. If they feel like we're coming to them just to show them how good we are and how righteous we are, and it doesn't take a whole lot for them to get that picture. And what I mean by that is, we have to be very careful in the way that we approach, because we might not even be self-righteous, we might not even be that judgmental, but sometimes the way we phrase things and the way that we word something can give that indication to somebody, because they're going to be very sensitive, they're going to be very vulnerable in this point of weakness. And so we are called as those who are strong, Galatians chapter 6, the passage we'll read in just a minute, to be very careful about how we approach this situation. For the very fact that they are a person who is weak, and they need someone who is strong, who has considered the situation to help them out. The second thing I would suggest about this is they find it difficult to correct their course. There are people who are weak who realize they need to change, but it's hard for them to understand how to do that. That they don't know how to get out of the situation they are in. Sometimes they have told themselves various stories about how they can't get out of this situation, and what they need is somebody who is sensible, who is loving, who is caring, that can guide them and show them there is a way out. That all hope is not lost. That they need to not fear, but they need to be strong, they need to trust in God, they need to do His will and not give up. They need someone who can encourage. Because often those in these situations feel a sense of hopelessness. They don't know how to get out of this situation. They don't know the answers, and so they feel like the situation is helpless. And beyond that, this might even be the worst thing, they feel like outsiders among their own brethren. They come and they try to do what they think they should do. Have you ever seen this happen or heard this happen? Someone is struggling. You know they're going through difficulty. They show up sometime, maybe Sunday morning or Sunday night, or they're here on a Wednesday, and they come in, and someone comes and says, "Well, I haven't seen you in a while." Do we really think that's helping someone who's weak? What is that doing? Let's just think about the situation for just a minute. We know they're weak. They know they're weak. We know they're struggling and they know they're struggling, but they have made an effort to come. They are here. What is the best way to help that person? In that moment, is it to point out that you have noticed all the times they aren't here in this moment when they have actually made an effort to be here? And then we wonder why they don't come back the next time. Because what they'll hear is, "Well, you came back again, so I haven't seen you for a whole lot of times, but hey, you made it 2 times in a row, way to go." So they feel like outsiders the moment they walk in the door. Now listen, they have some personal responsibility, and I understand that. But there's a reason why Paul says, "You who are spiritual, restore such a one in a spirit of meekness." There's a reason why he says in Colossians chapter 4 that our words are to be seasoned with salt. We're to speak with grace. We're to think carefully about the way that we say things. Because sometimes in people's effort to help the weak, they're really beating down on them. They're not guiding. They're not directing. They're pointing out to them even more glaringly what they already know, which is they are weak and they are struggling. And they already feel like outsiders among their own brethren, but now even more so because you've made it abundantly clear that they're not doing what everybody else is doing. I understand that it is tempting. And I understand that the intentions are not bad and the motivations are not wrong. And that the goal, very often, even in these situations, and when we say things in ways that we don't really mean for them to come out, is that we are looking at their best interest. But we need to stop and think about what is actually happening in the scenario. What is actually being conveyed by our words and by our actions? Is it really for their best interests? Are we really lifting their drooping hands? Are we really strengthening their weak knees by the way that we're reacting to them in that moment? It's a hard thing to master. It's kind of like evangelism. I mean, it's hard to say the right thing at the right time, isn't it? And it takes a lot of work. You have to force yourself to learn how to go through that process. And I think it's the same way with those who are weak. It is something that takes prayer. It takes commitment. It takes a lot of thought. It takes a showing of concern. And let me suggest some answer for something like this. Rather than pointing out to somebody the one time they've made it this month that you haven't seen them a whole lot, maybe call them at a time other than a service time. Maybe go see them and say, "I really care about you. I've noticed you haven't been there. I want to help you in any way I can. I'm here for you." There are other ways and other times to show somebody we care, or that we've noticed things, or we know that they're struggling. And we know that they know they're struggling. And that we are here to help them. We are here to help build them up because we are part of a congregation of people who are serving God together. So how can we help? Let's talk about some ways that we can help. How can we strengthen these drooping hands, strengthen the weak knees? How can we go about doing this? First of all, I'd say we need to sympathize with people. Jesus certainly sympathizes with us. That's what the scriptures say. He understands our struggle. That's what the book of Hebrews tells us in Hebrews chapter 4, 15 and 16. He lived as a man. And so he is this great high priest. And as this high priest, he has lived as a man. He understands our struggles, just like the high priest of the Old Testament who lived as men and they're going before God. They understand what it means to sin. And now they're pleading the cause for their people. Jesus came. He was tempted without sin in his life. But he understands what temptation is. He understands what that looks like. And now he can plead for us before God. For we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who in every respect has been tempted as we are, yet without sin. Let us then with confidence draw near to the throne of grace, that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in time of need. Jesus is there to sympathize. That's what the Hebrew writer tells us. He understands. He understands it is difficult, that there are struggles. He understands to its fullest degree because he never gave into it. Whatever persecutions we face, Jesus faced them in a worse way than we did because he was killed by people who were persecuting him. He knows what that's like. And so this is not a soft answer towards sin and saying just do whatever you want to do. We talked about that last night. It is just the reality that we understand we are human. And I need to be very careful in viewing that my sin is just a little bit better than somebody else's sin. I would never do what they have done. We've got to be careful when we think in those terms. And rather, think about what the travesty sin actually is. And how deceitful it is, like we talked about last night. And how we never imagine when we get into it how far it's going to take us and how terrible it's going to be. And realize that if we went down that same path, we could be just as deceived and try to sympathize with someone who is in the cauldron of sin and realize that we need to try to get them out of that as best we know how. And that we are there by their side, ready to help. If Jesus can sympathize with me, if Jesus, who never sinned, can sympathize with me and my weakness, who is there out there in the world around me that I cannot sympathize with? That I cannot feel together with in their sorrow for the sin they've been through? There's just inequality if I am thinking that way. If I can't understand the magnitude of the difference between Jesus sympathizing with me and my weakness and me being unwilling to sympathize with somebody else, I don't understand what it means to be a Christian and to follow Jesus Christ. Galatians chapter 6, text we've already alluded to, has this to say about helping those who are weak. Brothers, if anyone is caught in any transgression, you who are spiritual should restore him in a spirit of gentleness. Keep watch on yourself lest you too be tempted. Bear one another's burdens, and so fulfill the law of Christ. For if anyone thinks he is something when he is nothing, he deceives himself. It's interesting to me that Paul words all of that the way he does. That he recognizes that one of the big problems in trying to help someone who is weak is being tempted to sin myself. Not only that, but the type of sin. Verse 3, for if anyone thinks he is something when he is nothing, he deceives himself. It seems to me from this text and from some others, part of the process of trying to help those who are weak is realizing the humility it takes. The lowliness that needs to be a part of this process. Realizing that I am nothing. All I'm trying to do is to try to help somebody out. Who, like me, is a sinner. and needs to realize the desperate situation they're in this moment. Whatever their weakness might be, whatever struggles that they are having, is that this process is not something that involves me thinking about how great I am and how much they need me and holding up myself as some kind of stellar Christian and they're just somebody down there that needs my help. It's realizing that we're running this race together. That's where Hebrews 12 begins, isn't it? We're to run this race with endurance. We're to lay aside every hindrance and sin which so easily ensnares us. Notice as well, Galatians 6, how easy it is to be tempted. It's kind of like James' teaching on the tongue. When we think we've got it all figured out, that's when we're in the most danger. We think we've got the tongue all figured out. I don't have to worry about it anymore. That's when we're going to start having problems with it. That's the idea. You can't tame the tongue. When we think we've got this Christian thing figured all out and that we're not going to have any more issues anymore, that we got everything just right, we better watch out. Because the Hebrew writer and Paul and various other places in the New Testament tell us it is easy to fall. It is easy to be tempted into sin, even in the midst of trying to help somebody else out of it, Galatians 6, 1 through 3 tells us. And so we need to be gentle. We need to be sympathetic. We need to try to think where this person is. We need to try to think in their perspective, be in their shoes, and try to go through this in our mind, and what is the best way I can approach this person to save their soul, to help save their soul in this moment of weakness or in this moment of sin that they're going through. None of this means, however, that we are to just beat around the bush and not get to the point. There are various aspects that are involved in the idea of trying to help someone. Love covers a multitude of sin, Scripture tells us. And love does not mean we just gloss over problems or that we just overlook weakness, being gentle and being sympathetic. That doesn't mean you just go and say, well, I understand, or, you know, we all have problems, and then you leave it at that. That's not the answer. The answer is that we are real with each other. That's the whole idea of being vulnerable and open to each other. And in this congregation, we are ready to build each other up and to encourage, and that we're going to point out problems that we see, and we're going to be ready to receive criticisms of things that we are doing, because we are open and we want to do the best we can. And so we need to be honest and open. When Peter was speaking to Jesus, this is one account of this in Mark 8, 33. And he's trying to rebuke Jesus and say, these things aren't going to happen to you. You're not going to die. That's not going to be what happened. Jesus says, Satan wants to sift you like wheat. And another account, it says, get behind me, Satan. He's pretty open with him. He's pretty honest about the situation, isn't he? Direct, to the point. Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 15. This process in which we have apostles and prophets and evangelists and teachers for the building up of the body so that we all can grow to maturity. One of the things it says there in verse 15 is that we're to speak the truth to one another in love. You understand sometimes that truth hurts. We all get that. That's the idea Paul has there, that we got to speak the truth. We got to do it in love. Sometimes we have to say things to each other that are not comfortable to say, that are not fun to say. But of course, we need to be sympathetic. We need to be gentle. We go about this the best way that we can, but ultimately we have to be honest. You have to say, you might not like me very much for saying this, even though I care about you and that's why I'm doing it, but here's what's happening. And I'm worried about you. Or, this is what I've heard. Is this true? And if it is, we need to work on it. And I'm here for you. I want to help you. Because this is important. It's not something that we can just overlook. It's not something that we can just let go. Sin, as we talked about last night, is a horrible thing. It's an undermining of the will of God. Is a defiance to God, and it has to be taken care of. And unfortunately, so much of what we see in the world around us are a lot of things about these first two points, being sympathetic and being gentle, but you get to the being honest and taking care of the issue, and people kind of want to back away from that. Now, it's their own life. They take care of that themselves. Not if you're in a congregation. Not if you are part of the elect, part of God's people who are claiming a certain way of life. You've signed on for a certain kind of lifestyle when you say you're one of God's people, when you're one of the elect, you're one of the chosen, you're part of the royal priesthood. There's a certain lifestyle you said you're going to live as part of these people. And so when one of the elders or when someone else comes to you and says, I'm concerned, they'll say, well, it's my life. I can do what I know. It's not your life. It is Christ's life. And you've signed on for it. We better be open to some criticism. Better be open to taking the advice of others sometimes. Be willing to honestly listen to what someone is saying. Maybe we decide they're wrong. But at least being open to hear what someone is trying to tell us when they are concerned about our life. Because that's what we're here for. There's very little going to be accomplished if we can't have that as part of God's people. If we can't be holding each other to the standard of living that the Scriptures profess. And in fact, that is the very thing we are called to all over the New Testament. To walk worthy of the calling by which you've been called, he says in Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 1. And so if we aren't willing to do that, then why are we here? Are we just here to play church? To act religious? Are we here for the answers? Are we here for the truth? And on the other side of that, do we really believe? Are our brethren really that important to us? If they are, sometimes we have to do the hard thing, which is be open and be honest. They might not want to hear it, and it's not going to be fun. But that's what it means to be a brother. That's what Jacob should have been doing for Esau. Then there is this last point that I think is extremely important. If we are going to be open and honest with each other, we better be available. If we're going to be there to criticize, if we're going to be there to tell people their problems and tell them things they need to change, we better be there on the other side when they want help. Two are stronger than one, the wise man tells us. Sometimes people need help. Sometimes they need somebody there so when they fall down, they can be picked back up, right? That's what Solomon's saying there in Ecclesiastes chapter 4. Or the wise man in Proverbs 27, that as iron sharpens iron, one man sharpens another. It does very little good. It can accomplish good if someone just has a very sincere heart. If we just tell them all the problems and then we walk away and don't help, there can be good from that. But it is so much better if we're going to be the one to criticize that we're there on the other end to help as well. If we're there to point out their laundry list of problems, that we stand by their side when they're ready to change them. And so if we want to point out the weaknesses that people have in their lives, let's also point out to them that we love them and that we're going to be there with them every step of the way if they're willing to change. I think all of this is wrapped up in that verse in Galatians chapter 6, ultimately. We can go to some of these other passages to get the specific ideas that we've looked at tonight. Galatians 6 covers it so well, though. That people who are spiritual, they're going to restore this brother, this one who is transgressing, this one who is weak. They're going to do it in a spirit of gentleness or a spirit of meekness. And they're going to keep watch on themselves. They're going to make sure they're going to do this the right way. And it's not because they're so interested in pointing out wrongs and pointing out sins. It's because they're interested in saving souls. Because ultimately, all of this is to the glory of God, as Paul tells us in Ephesians chapter 1. That everything that we're doing and everything about the gospel message is the praise of His glory. It's not about man. It's not about how great we can be. And coming together and assembling is not about a piety show just to show how righteous I am. That's not what all of this is about. It is about bringing people together for the love of God and for the praise of His glory so we can be with Him for all eternity. And I hope people can see that. I hope people can see that in this congregation when you come together, that you come together because you love each other and because you love God. And that you want every single person that's a part of this congregation to be with you forever in the presence of God for all eternity. That's what a congregation of God's people should look like. I know that I can't comprehensively cover everything about how to help weak people in one sermon. But I hope in some small way this can help you. It's helped me thinking about some of these things and thinking through some of this and how I will address people or how I talk to somebody. It's so easy to put ourselves up on a pedestal and look down on those who we know are weak and who know they are weak. And almost talk down to them at times. But that is not the way we're going to strengthen the weak knees and lift the drooping hands. We need to tell them to fear not and to be strong. Because whatever they're going through right now, whatever struggles they have in life, there's going to be a time when God is going to return and He's going to vindicate His people, and it will be worth it all for them to push through the struggles and run that race with endurance. I don't know what you've been going through in your life. Only you can know that. And maybe it is that you've been struggling, that you are weak. And if you are here tonight and you're in that situation, that's great. I'm so glad that you've come. You might find it in your life that someone else is weak and they need your encouragement. Don't discount what you can do for the cause of Christ. But if you are weak in this moment and you need help, let somebody know. You don't have to come up here to the front and do it. You can do that if you want to. But let somebody you know, somebody you know well, and know what you're going through and that you need help. We need to be here for each other. If you're not a Christian, the honest truth for you tonight is that you need to be baptized into Jesus Christ, because if you are outside of Christ, the reality is you're going to suffer the wrath of God in the day of judgment. And I don't say that to be mean or to be ugly, but it is just to be truthful. God is going to come in judgment one day. And those who are not His, those who are not citizens of His kingdom, they're going to be on the outside and they're going to be destroyed. That's the picture we are given in Scripture. Don't be in that camp. Can we help you? Why don't you come now as we stand and we sing together?